is all that I can be. And maybe one day God will show me what I need. Right now, I'm not so sure about myself. Will I ever turn and face myself and learn to fly?
Aloha, I am your host, May Leilani, and this is the Universal Spiritual Connection. Mahalo to all the listeners of Paradise Pal Talk and BBSRadio.com. Our call-in numbers are USA toll-free 888-228-4494, Canada 877-489-6350. Our direct lines, same area code, 776-5154 and 776-5185 or 876-9916. I'd like to announce before we get started with our show for this evening is tonight is my last live broadcast for the year of 2007. So please jot a note down on your calendar that I will return back to live broadcasting on January the 9th, same broadcast time. So I look forward to once again seeing each and every one of you in 2008. And before I introduce my co-host for this evening, I also want to send out many, many blessings and a warm, warm holiday to each and every one of you. And my true desire is that each of you be wrapped in love and warmth and remember to celebrate the moments that you have spent and reflect on the year that we have all experienced, and to remember to always get ready, get set, to embrace the new year of 2008. I'd like to take this opportunity to welcome my co-host Francis to the show. Welcome, Francis.
Thank you, Leilani. It's wonderful to be here with you tonight.
It is great. I'm so excited as well that you are with us tonight. Would you like to share a little bit with our listeners this evening before we can invite our guests for this evening?
Thank you. Well as being a team leader with the World Global Healing Circle of Light, I'm a medium. I'm an intuitive tarot reader. I've been bringing forth angelic guidance and working with energy and healing for over 51 years now. I've recently started into animal communication, which I'm terribly excited about. And I teach classes in tarot and give personal readings in the Denver area, and I've been doing that for over 51 years now. I understand we have a very special guest this evening, Frank Joseph, who's going to be talking to us about the opening of the Ark of the Covenant.
Yes, and I tell you, Francis, I have been really looking forward to this show. It's been a personal interest of mine, so I ask that all the listeners assist Francis and myself giving our guest for this evening a warm welcome, Frank Joseph, to the show. Welcome, Frank.
Thank you very much, Leilani. It's a great pleasure to be here.
It is very exciting for us, and boy, do we have a lot of questions to ask you. But before we go any further in discussion, we would really appreciate it if you would share with all our listeners this evening about yourself.
Well, there's not really too much to tell. I originally am from Chicago, and my background is in journalism. And I think that's probably the most pertinent thing to what we're going to be talking about tonight, because when I began to examine the Ark of the Covenant, the book, which has just come out earlier this year, is the result of 26 years' research from my time
wow.
as a journalism student. and I applied the background that I had in journalism to investigating this problem. I didn't approach it as a channeler or as a New Age writer or as a historian or as a scholar. I approached it as a reporter. And I was only interested in writing this book to tell the truth to the very best of my ability. I'm not interested in theories. Whatever theories are in this book, they emerge from the facts that I've tried to present. And this book, Opening the Ark of the Covenant, is the result of 26 years, not just research in the libraries of the world, but literally going around the world several times. I've been to Egypt and Morocco, the Canary Islands. I've been all through Asia and the Hawaiian Islands as well, picking up clues everywhere I went, to which I feel is the most important single object that mankind has ever possessed. And that is the Ark of the Covenant. That's one of its names. It's gone through many names over the past. But
would you like to share some of
those?
I apologize for the interjection. Would you share real briefly the other names that they have used as well, referring to the Ark of the Covenant?
The Ark of the Covenant refers to an object, not just a box, but what the box contains. And the name Ark of the Covenant comes from the Hebrew Aron HaBarit. However, this very same object was possessed by peoples long before the ancient Israelites, and this was possessed by peoples long after them. That this object has gone through numerous peoples and cultures from before the beginning of recorded time, from deep in prehistory. In Japan, it was known as the Kanamanishi Stone. In the Canary Islands, it was known as the Phaira Stone. In ancient Egypt, it was known as the Phoenix Stone, literally the Benben Stone. And that is what the Ark of the Covenant contains. It contains a stone, a very special prized stone. The name Ark of the Covenant refers to an object which was considered so sacred that it could not be referred to directly. Just as in Islam, you cannot have any direct images of God, so in the ancient Hebrew religion, something as sacred as the Ark of the Covenant could only be referred to indirectly. The word Ark of the Covenant, or Aron HaBarit, refers to what the box contains. The Ark is nothing more than a vessel for this object.
Wow, and so, you know, and it's time for us to really get down to the truth of the matter and bringing that truth forward. So, first of all, I'd like to commend you for your dedication and, wow, 26 years of research. That's major. That's major years behind you. So I know that it's led you in many, many different directions of really breaking down illusions or misperceptions that has been in the forefront for quite some time. Wouldn't you agree, Frank?
Well, I think that that's very insightful of you to say that, because in putting this book together, I had many of my illusions and preconceptions absolutely shattered and replaced by things that I had no conception of. I did not begin 26 years ago to write this book. I began following other historical lines of research, but they all led up to the creation of this work. And the facts that I collected over time have gone into this. And they do have a tendency to be even radically, maybe even offensively sometimes, capacity for change is really remarkable in this. It paints a completely different view of the past than we were brought up to believe. But it offers something in compensation, and that is the spiritual key. And that's why I say that the Ark of the Covenant, or whatever name you want to call it, depending on what culture had it at the time, is the most single important object that mankind has ever possessed. It is, the reason why it is because it is a direct relationship to the higher spiritual nature in mankind.
Yes. Well, so this brings to thought, Frank, if you will, is, you know, it's obvious that you had a meaning behind the actual title of this book, Opening the Ark of the Covenant. Could you share your thoughts why you chose that particular title?
Well, it's really nothing too profound. I just felt that by opening the Ark of the Covenant, it means it's opening up its deeper meaning, its identity, its true origins. There's a great deal of information about the Ark of the Covenant in the Old Testament. As a matter of fact, the Ark of the Covenant is described in greater detail and more often than any other single object in the entire Old Testament, the entire Bible. So there's a lot of information about it. But if you look at it only in terms of the Hebrew experience, you cut yourself off from its experience in many other parts of the world, literally around the world. In Tibet, it was known as the Chintamani Stone. It's just a remarkable experience. I've encountered nothing like this. And even though we don't possess the Ark of the Covenant today, although in the book I posit several possible locations where it might be, it is possible for anyone to tap into it, to access it, even without being in its presence. And I think that that is just a really remarkable thing in itself.
Yes, I agree with you. You know, it's really interesting because you have, you know, I know for my own journey, because I've always been led and done a lot of research myself, and I can really appreciate, finally, we have a man that, you know, this was a passion of his and really dedicated many years of research to break down those walls of illusion. And so I really want to learn more, so much more from you. Now, what does this actually mean for humanity?
It means this in a nutshell. There was a book that came out some years ago, about maybe 10 years ago. It was written by an atheist named Alpert. It's called The God Part of the Brain. And it deals with a part of the brain called the hippocampus. The hippocampus has now been determined by medical science to be literally the seat of the soul. In other words, if the hippocampus of the human brain is properly stimulated, the person experiences altered states of consciousness. The whole psychic gamut appears to be in the hippocampus. Now, the atheist who wrote this book called The God Part of the Brain says that, well, the hippocampus can be used to explain away all religion and religious phenomena, spiritual phenomena. But it's like having a telephone that has no connection. Obviously, if this thing is connected to one's spiritual being, there is something beyond just the organ itself. Now, how this relates to the Ark of the Covenant is this way. I believe that this stone, which was inside the Ark of the Covenant, and still is inside the Ark of the Covenant, was able to access the hippocampus of the human brain, was able to stimulate it in such a way was to maximize its spiritual potential. So all of the things that we're thinking about today in the New Age, psychic phenomena, telepathy, out-of-body experiences, astral projection, the whole lot is just the tip of the iceberg of the godlike potential that has resided in each human being. It takes a mystical experience in order to supercharge the hippocampus of the brain, to bring these innate qualities and potentials out. And I believe that the stone, and that's what it was, a stone inside the Ark of the Covenant, was used specifically to stimulate the God part of the brain. And if that can be done, the society that possesses this object will experience a golden age. If there's any single theme that runs through my book, and there are several, but this one specifically is, whoever possesses the Ark of the Covenant, or whatever you want to call it, and who uses it properly, that society experiences a golden age. It's only
we
when
have
that...
I apologize,
no,
Frank.
No, go ahead. No, go ahead. No, just, your input is important.
Please forgive me. We have a question that has been presented. Alpha Angel would like to know what the color is. I would think she's referring to the stone.
If she's referring to the box, which she might be, that's really the Ark is the box. That, of course, is gold. It was made of acacia wood covered with gold leaf. However, the stone itself is of an incredible clarity, superb clarity. The stone appears to be an electronic quartz crystal. Now, those of you who know what an electronic quartz crystal know that its rutilations, or the striations that are in each crystal, have been straightened out so that the crystal appears to be very, very clear with very few occultions. And that I don't believe it was color, had any color to it at all. However, this is interesting that she brings this up. The stone itself is colorless, crystal clear. However, when the stone is activated, it produces a blue light, a blue haze, which is known to geophysicists as the Andes glow. I haven't got time to go into it. It's a long, involved thing, but it's a corona discharge. It's an electronic phenomena. It creates a blue haze, and that this color blue is associated with the stone when it is being activated.
I can actually see that, by the way, and I'm glad you brought that up, Frank. Now I'm really wanting to sink my teeth into this. And you know what's interesting? Do you also find that when it's activated, it gives off this blue aura around it? I also saw very quickly that there's a vortex of energy that starts to build as well. Did you find that?
Absolutely correct. It's a very powerful vortex. It's a dangerous vortex. All spiritual power is like any other power, like atomic power, electrical power. If it's used properly, it can do great things. If it's used improperly, it can be very lethal. And the Ark of the Covenant, according to the Old Testament itself, has killed literally tens of thousands of people because it was abused. It was used one time as a kind of biblical weapon of mass destruction. And when that was abused, it turned on its operators. It became a very dangerous thing. So, yes, there is a very powerful vortex. It was not designed to do that, though. That's when it's abused. Its main, its chief purpose is to be able to activate that hippocampus of the brain, not just of an individual who's with it. I'm not talking only about the person who possesses it. I'm talking about an entire society. When it's installed in its proper location, and its previous locations were Solomon's Temple, of course, that's the most famous one, but before that it was in the Great Pyramid of ancient Egypt. And each time that the stone was installed in its proper setting, it irradiated an entire society and uplifted it to a golden age by stimulating the hippocampus of residents, citizens in the area.
Thank you, Frank. We've got a lot of questions that we're being flooded with, but I do want to honor my co-host, Frances. She has a really great question that she'd like to present to you. So, Frances, come on and ask your question to Frank, and then we'll get to the other questions in a moment.
Thank you, Leilani. In my research, Frank, regarding the Ark of the Covenant, there are descriptions of the contents being that it contained a golden jar of manna, that Aaron's staff, which had budded. It describes the stone tablets brought down from from the mount by Moses that were broken, as well as the replacement tablets. How did you come to the conclusion, or what led you to the conclusion, that there was a presence of another object in this stone that you're talking about?
Well, that shows that you've done really great research. All these objects you're talking about, if they were really in the Ark of the Covenant, it would be physically impossible, because the Ark of the Covenant, we have very specific dimensions. We know exactly how large it was. It's described in great detail in the Book of Moses. It's generally about 3.5 feet long and maybe about 2.25 feet across, 2.25 feet high. It would be impossible for a box like this to contain all the things that are supposedly associated with it. Now, those things like Aaron's rod and the manna from heaven and gifts from the Philistines and all this other stuff, this is the accretion of mythic material over time. This is a natural process that happens to any object or anything or any person over time. Legend and myth have a tendency to accumulate. Now, if you go back to the original sources, now those objects that you mentioned can all be traced, and I've traced them all back to myths that accumulated over time, as I said. But if you go back to the original sources, and I'm talking about the Talmud, for example, it says that originally the only thing that was inside the Ark of the Covenant was a single stone, which was double inscribed. And here we have a linguistic problem, and that is over time, translations and mistranslations have given us the idea that there were two stone tablets inside the Ark of the Covenant, and they both contained the Ten Commandments. That idea was then bloated by Michelangelo. We have his famous sculpture of Moses holding the Ten Commandments on these granite tablets, and the image that is in our minds today is of Charlton Heston walking down the side of a mountain in Cecil B. DeMille's movie. But the original says that the stone, it was referred to as a sapphire, that the sapphire stone was double inscribed with the Ten Commandments. In other words, it was one stone that had the Ten Commandments inscribed on either side. The word sapphire is also misleading. It is a poetical metaphor, meaning a precious stone. It even says in the Talmud that it was not really a sapphire. It was like a sapphire. It was a precious stone. And that stone appears to be in related and complementary traditions as being a crystal of very great clarity, exceptional clarity. And this story of the Ten Commandments being inscribed on this stone is found around the world. The Chintamani stone that I mentioned, all the way in Tibet on the other side of the world, it refers to it as having words of wisdom inscribed on it. And you find this theme that goes back into deep prehistory. The Incas had the same thing, the Intihuatana stone. The stone on Easter Island was called the Tepito Te Cura, the stone of light. These high societies all had either the same stone or stones that were similar to it. So what you're saying about the other objects that were found in the Ark of the Covenant, that is the accumulation of a mythic tradition and nothing more.
One of the references that I found refers to the ability of the Ark of the Covenant to clear the path for the nations, and I assume here that they were talking about the Israeli nation, by burning snakes and scorpions and thorns, and it describes two jets of flame that shot from its underside. It says that rather than being carried by its bearers, the Ark, in fact, carried its bearers inches above the ground. Could this be the effect of the stone that you're talking about?
Yes, it is. And that's interesting because there are several Jewish traditions that talk about the Ark as it's being pulled across the wilderness, where the Israelites would sometimes collect scorpions and lizards and put them over the top of the Ark of the Covenant. The top of the Ark of the Covenant was what is known as the mercy seat, and this was a concentric dish or dishes, and either side of them were representations of two cherubim, and that whenever an object was put in between these two wings of these cherubim, which were extended and almost touching but not quite, a great electrical charge would flash out, and or they would describe it not as electrical charge, but as a flash of fire, and would incinerate or vaporize the object, whatever it was, scorpions and so forth. This is nothing more than we're discussing here is an electrical discharge from a capacitor. A capacitor is a device or part of a device which accumulates electrical energy. Matter of fact, your own body, the body is a capacitor. If you go across a shag carpet and you reach for a brass doorknob, you're going to know what's going to happen. There's going to be a little shock that's going to go from the tip of your finger to that brass doorknob. That's exactly what was happening with the Ark of the Covenant as the Israelites were taking it across the Promised Land. They're bringing it across this area. Some of this area that they went across was seismically charged. And this capacitor stone that was inside the Ark of the Covenant would accumulate this energy as static discharge. And then when polarization took place between the two extended wings of these highly conductive gold objects, you'd have electrical discharge. And so what you're describing is really nothing more than a piece of high-tech device. This is the hardest thing for really critics to swallow, and I was very resistant for a long time. How can we imagine an electrical capacitor? Anybody would understand the application of electronics thousands of years ago, but the evidence is beyond question, in my opinion. There's no doubt that the Israelites possessed, on their way to the Promised Land, an electronic device, a capacitor. It's not only a device that was outstanding for its time. It's a device that hasn't been invented since. We have reached the point in our civilization where we can understand that device and even reproduce it, but we have not yet made it. We're that close to it. So when they talked in the Bible about sheets of fire coming out of the Ark of the Covenant, that's because they had, the writers of the Bible had no experience of electrical energy. But the possessors of the Ark of the Covenant did. There was always an elite clan called the Levites. These were priests who had exclusive access to the Ark of the Covenant. No one else did because it was dangerous, and they were the handlers of it. But there's no doubt that what they had was a piece of electronic equipment which they had inherited from previous civilizations, previous cultures. It fell into their hands, and that it's most famously known to us as the Ark of the Covenant, but as I say, many other cultures knew it by many other names.
Wow. I'd like to take a moment, if I may, and welcome all the listeners that have just tuned in to the Universal Spiritual Connection. Our special guest for this evening is Frank Joseph, and he is the author of the title of the book called Opening the Ark of the Covenant. And I'd like to share the call-in numbers with all our listeners for this evening, if you'd like to call in and speak directly to Frank. And those numbers are toll-free 888-228-4494, Canada, 877-489-6350. Our direct lines are same area code 530-776-5154 or 776-5185 and 876-9916. I'd also like to personally invite each of our listeners this evening to the show to visit my show page. I have a wealth of information about Frank and his wonderful book that he has written. And Frank, let me ask you real quick, if our listeners are interested in purchasing your book, where may they go to purchase it?
Probably the best place is Amazon.com. They can get probably just the best access is on Amazon.com. It is in some Barnes & Noble and Borders bookstores, but not all of them.
Excellent. I'd like to go ahead and take this moment to share some of the questions from the listeners. And Starbelt says here, I heard that the Ark of the Covenant was the object that parted the Red Sea for Moses.
My investigation of that is not the case, that the Ark was not capable of doing anything like that. The reason, though, why that story is included is because that was part of the Israelite experience. And the Ark of the Covenant was their most sacred object, and they attributed some things to it that it was not capable of doing. That story of parting of the Red Sea is interesting because that same story, the exact same story, was told in two different versions by the ancient Egyptians literally thousands of years before the Exodus took place. We have to understand that the Old Testament is an accumulation of myths that the Hebrew people, being a Mosaic people, absorbed from the cultures they passed through. So it's difficult sometimes to separate what is truly representative of the Israelite experience and what is part of the mosaic that they absorbed from others. For example, the story of the flood. The Hebrew people never experienced the Great Flood. That's a story, though, that is very legitimate, and it comes from the Sumerian culture. And this story, too, about the parting of the Red Sea is an old, very old story that goes back to two different Egyptian versions about parting of the Red Sea. And this is a typical mode of developing an epic, and that's really what the Bible is. You know, the Bible is a great poetical epic, and people that are always trying to prove its facts fall flat. The Bible is not interested in fact. The Bible is interested in truth, and in order to present truth, you have to include it in a poetical form. Facts can be changed, they can be outdated, they can be invalidated, but truths are eternal, and that is what the Old Testament is about. Truth is about the eternal truths that are discussed. And sometimes these truths are discussed in mythic form. So when it says in the Old Testament that the Jews passed through the Red Sea and the Ark of the Covenant was there, they are saying, in effect, that they are the inheritors of the same purifying tradition that was known to other peoples before them. That's all. The Ark of the Covenant, we have to understand, was an electronic device. I have to stress that. And it was capable of some very great things, but its chief purpose was to alter human consciousness. It could also do things on a practical level by transforming one form of energy into another. That really is all that it did. It's a solid-state device. In other words, it's like an old transistor radio. It doesn't have any moving parts other than the dial, but it is able to take one form of energy and transform that energy, magnify it, and amplify it into a different form of energy. And if you would put, for example, thought or prayer into this thing, it would expand that energy and transform it. And if you knew exactly how to do it and how to access your hippocampus and the hippocampus of an entire nation, you had incredible control and unbelievable power at your disposal.
Before I present the next question, what I was seeing as well, and I'd like to go ahead and just bring this out to you, Frank, is I actually, and maybe you can shed some light on this, was the stone able or has the capacity to transport matter into particles and transfer from one space to the next, meaning a person could actually transport themselves through the stone?
It would be possible only, yes, I would, to answer your question in one word, yes. But it would only be possible through a great spiritual and intellectual discipline. The stone itself has no power. It's nothing.
Right.
Its power is inert. You must bring something from the outside, something of yourself or something from the environment directed at the stone. And in doing that properly, your potential for achieving things like that is literally limitless. The stone, to explain this in the simplest way that I possibly can, the stone was originally made by a pre-Hebrew people, a pre-Egyptian people. The stone was originally carved or crafted, as it were, for one purpose only, and that was to transmute seismic activity, seismic forces, into electronic forces. Why would anybody want to do that? Not to apply electricity, but rather to dissipate seismic violence. If you're living in an area that is of great geologic upheaval, by having this device in its proper setting, you would be able to ameliorate the worst effects of earthquakes and to transmute the tectonic forces of the earth into a harmless electrical discharge. When that happened, that was, in other words, it began strictly, this object was used strictly for mundane purposes. However, when that happens, it produces a tremendous amount of negative ions, a huge amount of negative ions, such as has never been seen since. And it is those negative ions which interface with the hippocampus of the human brain, the God part of the brain. And when, in other words, it's like a residual effect, it's like a collateral effect of its original industrial purpose, which was to ameliorate the worst effects of earthquakes by transforming tectonic forces into electrical discharges. When that takes place, the negative ions build up and create a tremendous aura. The builders of this stone, the makers of the stone, saw that and then were able to apply it to a broader level where it was not only used for pre-industrial purposes, but was also used for now spiritual purposes. And by doing that, by understanding it, you could achieve things that we can't even imagine. I think the whole concept of our new age today that really began about 40 years ago is just the very beginning, just almost a sense of our psychic potential, which the ancients knew to a far greater degree than we will know for a long time yet. But the Ark of the Covenant is surfacing, as it were, in the consciousness of people today because there's a kind of an instinctual knowing or longing for this lost knowledge, which is in that stone. That stone, if that was stone was possessed today and properly applied, our society would be utterly transformed. We would be, the society that would result would be, have no, virtually no resemblance to the society we have today.
I have a special hello to you, Frank, from Alice. She is tuned in to the show, and so she's listening to the broadcast right now. And I just wanted to make sure I presented her hello to you directly. Frances, I know that you had another question that you would like to present. Please, by all means, go ahead.
Oh, I've been sitting back here just waiting to jump in. I am so excited about this. It is commonly held in all of the research that I did that the location of the Ark of the Covenant is presently under Golgotha. And yet your research, Frank, takes us to an entirely different part of the world and brings this effect of the stone into more modern usage. Can you explain a little bit about where you believe the Ark is and how it's related to the Lady of Light?
There is no contradiction in any of this. You are right. This object, in order to be understand where it might be, and I don't claim to know exactly where it is. I think there are some really good candidates. I think there are a few particularly good candidates for its present location. I have one chapter which deals with possible locations, and they're all over the map. There's dozens of places. The reason why is not that these stories are all incorrect, and there can only be one place for it. The technology that made this stone, the technological society that made this stone so long ago, was really no different than ours in this respect, and that is, if we can make one space shuttle, we're going to make more than just one. We make several. The technology that can produce the Challenger can also produce the Atlantis and all the rest of them. And I believe the same thing appertained in the past, that the technology that was possible to make one of these stones made quite a few. Well, several anyway. Not hundreds, I wouldn't say, but maybe dozens. Because these different stones are many different parts of the world. We know for sure, for example, that one of these stones is still in Easter Island that I mentioned. It's called the Tipito Tikura, or the Navel of Light. That stone still exists. If you go to Easter Island, you can see it. It's basically the same stone that's inside the Ark of the Covenant. So I think that it's conceivable that there are several of these stones which are still around today. However, these stones, the one that went into the Ark of the Covenant, which may or may not have been better than the others, I don't know, but certainly was very powerful, that is the interesting one. Where is the Ark of the Covenant itself? In my research, and the research with my wife, Laura Bodwin, she's my co-author in this, and without her, the book could not have been written, we have narrowed it down to about two or three different places where we think the Ark could be. One of them is in France, in the Pyrenees Mountains. It's a long story. I don't have time to explain it, but it made its way to the Pyrenees Mountains in the Middle Ages, and there's a very good chance that that cave that contains this object exists. And the reason why we think so, in a nutshell, and I guess the most obvious way, is that the cave where this Ark of the Covenant, maybe, is a very short distance, literally walking distance, or should I say pilgrimage distance, from a very sacred site, one of the premier sacred sites of the world, and that is Lourdes. Lourdes, the effects that go on there of healing coincide with some of the properties associated with the Ark of the Covenant. So it's conceivable, rather, that the Ark of the Covenant is in this cave in the Pyrenees, not far from Lourdes. However, there are additional lines of evidence which point very far away from Lourdes. And this probably is the single most incredible aspect of this whole incredible story. There is a very considerable line of evidence which shows that the Ark of the Covenant was taken from its last known position, which was in the Pyrenees Mountains. I think we've made an excellent case for showing that the Ark did make it to the Pyrenees Mountains in 1244. In literally March 19th, how about that? March 19th, 1244, the Ark of the Covenant was last seen in the Pyrenees Mountains on the French side. After that, however, the line of evidence convincingly shows that something like the Ark, if not the Ark itself, left France and went to Spain. After it was in Spain, in Barcelona, a monastery called Montserrat, just outside of Barcelona, it was there for hundreds of years, moved back to Spain, or back to France, rather, and from France crossed the Atlantic Ocean to Canada and was involved in the founding of the city, the modern city of Montreal. The modern city of Montreal was found by a group of people who were nothing more than modern French equivalents, or 17th century equivalents of the Levite priests. And there the Ark of the Covenant was set up in what they tried to create as the New Jerusalem. Now, this is all solid history, by the way. I'm not making any of this up, or this isn't theory. This really happened. There was a group of people called the Villa Maries, or the House of Mary, and that these were highly spiritualized people who set up something called the New Jerusalem in Montreal. We're talking about the mid-17th century now, about 1660, 1670, something like that. This is a historically validated, recognized part of Canadian past. And that they created, interestingly enough, the very first permanent building in Montreal, and part of it still exists, was a duplicate of Solomon's Temple. Now, why was Solomon's Temple made in the first place? Was to house the Ark of the Covenant. So we think, and it sounds very thin the way I'm explaining it here, but the amount of documented material that we have to show this story shows that it indicates that something like the Ark, if not the Ark of itself, some people do believe that the Ark did go to Montreal, Canada. It is not there anymore. Because the Via Maries, the people that tried to create this New Jerusalem, their society was torn apart in the end between the military forces of France and England fighting over Montreal. And that the object was taken away from the New Jerusalem in Montreal before this confrontation took place. And the indications are, I'm cutting to the chase here, that the object was taken by one of the most famous explorers in American history. His name was Ferdinand de La Salle. And Ferdinand de La Salle was accompanied by a French priest, a French Catholic priest. His name was Father Jean Baudouin. This is all solid history, by the way. This is all documented and backed up. You have to fill in the spaces and the dots in certain places, but these people really existed in this time period I'm talking about. And they really did these things I'm telling you. And so LaSalle and Father Baudouin, they took a ship which they made. It's called Le Griffon. And the Le Griffon was the first ship to sail the Great Lakes. And the reason why they went through the Great Lakes was to find a place for the Ark of the Covenant. And they finally went down through what is now Chicago, down what is now the Illinois River, into a place known today as Peoria, known in those days in the 17th century as Crèvecoeur. And it was at Crèvecoeur that Father Baudouin and LaSalle, especially Father Baudouin, decided that the Ark of the Covenant could not be returned to Europe. It was impossible because Europe was in the throes of despotism. It could not go back to Canada because Canada was now a battleground between the French and the British. And so Father Baudouin took this object, the Ark of the Covenant, so we trace. There are some gaps in this story, but there's a lot of historical documentation for it. And so Father Baudouin went a little bit further south, down the Mississippi River, and then up into Illinois, and a small river called the Ambaras River. And it was at the Ambaras River that he befriended and converted an Indian tribe known as the Yuchi Indians. And he gave this object to the Yuchi Indians. The Yuchi Indians have been the custodians of this object since about 1680. And the Yuchi Indians actually have a tradition of this object. There's not many of the Yuchi Indians left. Most of them perished on the Trail of Tears. They no longer live in Illinois. They were moved out of Illinois into what is now Columbia, Georgia. But they have this tradition. And the story is that the Ark of the Covenant, the one that we read about in the Bible, is now in a cave in southern Illinois. Hard as that is to believe. Now, we're not the only ones that think this is possible, because there is a conglomerate company now which is trying to excavate this object, has been trying to excavate the object for the last 9 years. And it's a difficult process, but as we speak, they're doing core drillings and excavations. They have already invested literally tens of thousands of dollars in trying to get this object. This is a real thing. This is an ongoing thing that's taking place today. So to answer your question, is a long answer, I know, but it's conceivable. We don't know for sure, but it's conceivable that the Ark of the Covenant may actually today rest in Illinois, in a cave in southern Illinois, where it was brought by Father Baudouin and LaSalle in the late 17th century.
Wow, I could talk to you forever, Frank, about this subject, and it's so refreshing to have someone that has really dedicated their lives into the research and to bring this information forward, because you tonight have accomplished breaking down a lot of the misperceptions and untruth that is out there today. And that's very nice and very refreshing.
Well, very kind of you to say so. When I wrote this book and put it together, I was not interested in theories or trying to prove anything or convince anybody. I just really wanted to know what really happened. And I wanted to, if you see in the back of the book, I have quite a thick bibliography that I've collected over the years, and I really tried to nail down as much historical record as possible. And there's a lot of historical record out there that flushes all this out. So what I'm telling you, and I'm telling our listeners, is that this material can be and is very well documented.
Yes. I'd like to present another question. We've got floods of questions to ask you, but I'd like to go ahead and share one with you. And Alpha Angel says, I would love for Frank to elaborate on how mankind can tap into this energy, or can they?
Yes, they can, and it's very simple. I think that the basis for spirituality is not as complicated as many people make out. And that is meditation. It's been said so many times. And there's many ways, of course, to meditate. The only thing I would say about meditation is that any form of meditation which does not seek primarily to clear the mind is not meditation. So whatever form you use, breath meditation or whatever, just to clear the mind. When you do that, when you go through your process, whether it's ornate or simple or long or short, if at the end or the climax of your meditation you visualize the Ark of the Covenant, everybody knows what it looks like. You don't have to get a copy of my book to see a picture of it. It's a very well-known icon of our civilization. Just visualizing it, just holding that in the mind, or having a photograph of it, creates a resonance, creates a bond. Now, this is a very, very old spiritual concept that goes way back to ancient Egypt, if not before, and that is the concept of sympathetic magic. What that means is a powerful spiritual symbol or object you're able to connect with by just making a replica of it. For example, I'll give you an example of the cross that Christ died on. Now, if you take a simple plastic crucifix, something you can buy anywhere for a couple of bucks, even that possesses something of the original. Why? Let's say, for example, I took that plastic cross of Jesus and I threw it on the ground and I stepped on it. Everybody would be horrified. And they'd be horrified because there is something of the original in even that cheesy reproduction.
Yes.
And
yes,
it's the same thing. We create a resonance with these objects. And when that happens, you can tap into it. I don't believe that you have to have the Ark of the Covenant or be in its immediate proximity in order to benefit from it. I think you can establish a rapport with it. And when you do that, it's a form of spiritual empowerment. You will notice things in your life, for example, an increase in synchronicity or meaningful coincidence. There will be a general sense of empowerment and clarity. And who knows how far you can take it from there. I think that the Ark is a tool which can be used for good or for evil. And like any power, it has its negative and positive sides. But that is to answer the question as simply as I can, the best way to tap into the Ark of the Covenant, I believe, is through meditation and visualization if you can. Not everybody can visualize, have a photograph or a reproduction or whatever. You can connect with it. I think you can. I know my wife and I definitely have.
I agree with that 100%. And it's really interesting because, you know, as you've been sharing on the show tonight, I've actually received visions, and that's where I was asking you some of the questions. You know, I saw the energy vortex increasing its energy, and then seeing matter being moved from one space to the next. And so I'd like to ask you one other question because we are getting close to the end of our show, and we have a question here that says, can the power of this stone be so great to move energy?
Absolutely. That's what I really love about this program tonight is I think all the questions have been right on and very insightful. That's what the stone is all about. It's all about energy. It's about accumulating energy. It's highly sensitive to energy. It was built specifically to respond to seismic forces in order to get rid of earthquakes or ameliorate earthquakes. However, in doing this, I believe that the engineers of this stone realized that it was so highly sensitive that it was responsive to human thought patterns, which is really nothing more than a form of energy anyway. It's an energy manipulator. It's an accumulator. And if you know how to use it, it can be the most powerful single object that human beings have ever possessed. It far outstrips atomic power, electrical power, any kind. Because, as Edgar Cayce said, he was asked, is atomic power the greatest power that mankind has ever had? And he said, no, because spiritual power is the greatest power human beings have ever possessed, because spiritual power underscores all other kinds of power. Without that, there is nothing else. I think
Absolutely.
That the Ark of the Covenant stone was
and
the
that,
prime spiritual power stone. That's what it was. The Egyptians referred to it as the Phoenix stone, the Benu stone, or the Ben stone, the fire stone, the stone of destiny. They called it the stone of destiny. It's just the same thing that was in the Ark of the Covenant. And being
well,
the stone of destiny
means
it had limitless potential.
That brings me to two other, one is a question, one is more of a comment, and I'm sure that you can share your thoughts in both areas, and let me present both of them to you. Earth Warrior says, did I miss why these stones went into hiding or are no longer used? The second that has been presented is from Cirrus, and the comment here is, I like the geoelectric power idea, but by the time you drilled enough holes, you'd already have an earthquake. So I'll let you share your thoughts on those two areas.
Well, yeah, the idea of the stone is it must be in its proper setting. I can't stress that enough, that if it's just in a cave or it's being hauled around in a gold box across the Near East, it's not going to behave properly. It's going to be a loose cannon. That is why specific places, like Solomon's Temple, and the Great Pyramid were made. These buildings and buildings like them were made specifically to house this stone. The technology and the design that went into the Great Pyramid is essentially the similar. It's almost exactly, it is exactly the same as in Solomon's Temple. One of the fascinating things that I found out is that Solomon's Temple, and we have this in tremendous detail, that his Holy of Holies, it was called the Debir in Hebrew, the place where the Ark of the Covenant was kept in its own room, its internal dimensions are precisely the same as the internal dimensions of the King's Chamber and the Great Pyramid. That's not even enough. A study was done in the 1950s and the 1960s at the University of Wisconsin by two different professors who made reproductions of the Ark of the Covenant exactly as described in the Old Testament, and they found that the Ark of the Covenant slips perfectly with inside the so-called sarcophagus inside the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid. So the volume of the Great Pyramid's sarcophagus is just slightly larger than the volume of the Ark of the Covenant described in the Old Testament. So that not only shows a connection between King Solomon's temple, the first temple of Jerusalem, and the Great Pyramid, but it also shows that this thing had to be in its proper position. If it wasn't, it'd be like removing, for example, a capacitor from some highly powerful electronic device.
Absolutely.
The electronic device itself would now be rendered useless, and the capacitor itself would not be able to be directed with the energy that accumulates in it. So
that's right.
It must be in its proper
Frank.
Position.
I apologize for interjecting, but we are coming to the close of this show, and we'll just have to have you back, Frank. It has been an incredible, powerful show, and I personally want to thank all our listeners this evening. I will have to share with you, Frank, everyone has been extremely excited for you being with us here tonight. They just love you, as many of the comments, and they're looking forward to hearing more information from you. And real quick, could you give... Pardon me, everybody. If you're interested in purchasing Frank Joseph's book, you can go on to Amazon.com. The title of his book is Opening the Art of the Covenant. And so I really want to thank you. If I have not presented your question, please forgive me. Before we say goodnight to all of you, remember, this is my last live broadcast for 2007. Please take a note on your calendar that I will be back broadcasting live on January the 9th at the same time. I personally want to thank my co-host, Francis, for being with us tonight. You've done an incredible job as a co-host, Francis, and I thank you. What great questions you presented. And Frank, thank you for your dedication of 26 years of research to bring to all of us this evening. It's been a real honor to have you.
Well, the honor is all mine.
Thank you. We'll have you back on again, I promise you. If you want to come back and join us, we'd love to have you with us.
I'd love to be back.
Thank you. On that note, I want to wish each and every one of you a very, very Merry Christmas and a great New Year's, and make it all about enjoying your family, your friends, your neighbors, and always remember to have love very present, not only for yourselves, but to share among your family and friends. I want to say goodbye to each of you for 2007, and I look forward to our new adventure for 2008. Bless each and every one of you. Good night. Good night, Frank, and good night, Francis.
all that I can be. And maybe one day God will show me what I need. Right now, I'm not so sure about myself. Will I ever turn and face myself and learn to fly? I've always heard that mirrors never lie, but that's not true because I see a man but feel a child. There are some of us who can hear a voice inside, a truthful voice that says, yes, you were born to fly, you were born to fly. We were born to fly high. We were born to fly, and so was I. I ask myself, what will I come to be? I have a choice now, so I guess it's up to me. Maybe I will make a difference in this world. Maybe I will teach another boy or another girl how to fly. Teach them all that they were born to fly. Then we were born to fly, and so was I. But when you live in a world that tells you that you can't, and when you live in a world that says you must be something other than what you are, in a world that forgets, he was born to fly. We were born to fly. We were born to fly.